Okay, let's do it one more time. Ready? I will lift my eyes to the hills and their creator who made both heaven and earth. For he who watches me never sleeps, no, never slumbers. He's ever over me. As I come and I go, I am safe, for I know that his love is sufficient for me. Winter warmth and light and a shady place in summer, he's ever over me. Lovely. Gracious Lord, what a great, inestimable comfort it is to know that you are ever over us, always there, always gently guiding, always encouraging, always leading us gently home to the harbor of grace. Can't wait to get there. Can't wait to see you. Can't wait to see our loved ones. This world is waxing old like a garment, and we're getting tired. And we just love to go home. But in the meantime, we will serve you faithfully. So as we contemplate the human mind and the development of character. Guide my thoughts and my words, and give each person here an open mind to listen. In Jesus' name, amen. Read with me. Let the renewing of your mind transform you. Am I blasting everybody out?
No.
Okay. Another one, together. Be changed on the inside by letting your mind be made new again. Okay, review. What's hardwired mean? They are predisposed to a particular environment and they can't change. Right? Every creature on earth is hardwired for the environment that they are placed in, with one exception. Human beings. And we said human beings are live-wired, right. And what does live-wired mean? Right. Adaptable to any environment that you put them in. Their minds are born like a blank sheet of paper, and they are able to adapt to any environment, any situation, any language, any culture. They can adapt to any of that. Yes? Bingo. You get a gold star. I don't have any, but if I can, I give you one. Fake one, that's right. Yeah. So when a baby is born, all of the neurons, how many neurons in a baby's brain? Approximately 100 billion. How many synapses? About 2,500 synapses per neuron, right? And then each synapse is capable of approximately 10,000 connections. So in the human mind of a baby, the potential is for a quadrillion different connections between the neurons in a brain. Incredible. When it says in the spirit of prophecy that when we get to heaven, we will be learning unendingly. We will go from levels of knowledge to on and grow unendingly. How is that possible? You can see that when you see the potential of the human brain. Okay. A child's brain, when they're born, immediately begins making approximately 2 million connections every second. They form new synapses, new connections, and are in the process of continually forming new paths in their brain as they learn. And those new paths are like a path that goes through a forest. And every experience that happens to them as a child, they're learning something new. All of that input is going into the brain and it stays in there. If you're a parent, one of the most disconcerting things is when your child, 5 years old, starts saying things to you back that you said that you didn't think that they ever heard or assimilated. And you're going, what? How did they possibly know that or remember that? I know because we've got two grandkids here right now. And you have to be careful because they're assimilating it all and they're putting it all in. Okay, let me see here. Okay, the next one. The basic premise here is that science's explanation is that a baby's mind is remarkably unfinished. In other words, they have no clue what this means or how it works. So a child becomes an adult not by growing brain cells, but by the selective elimination by creating paths. And the paths that they create begin a process of elimination of brain cells that are unused. And we said that they go from approximately 100 billion brain cells to, as an adult, how many? You remember? About 23 billion in men and about 19 billion in women. So they have dropped to less than, what percent is that, 20%? Less than 20% of their brain. Now, if you consider how much of that 23 and 19 billion cells that are in an adult brain actually get used on a daily basis, you're looking at between 5 and 10% of those that actually get used. So the capabilities in a human mind are beyond anything that you can imagine if we really wanted to work it. I've got to show you this video. This is the one I wanted to show you yesterday, and I can't get it to work. So I'm going to just stay with me here. I'm going to get out of this, and I want to show you this little clip here. Okay, so now we're going to transition into teen years, all right, when puberty hits. Two major events happen in the brain at the same time. When you become a teen, and I'm not sure which happens first, but all of a sudden there's this tsunami of hormones that begins to flow through your body, and it triggers something in your cerebral cortex. Now, I don't know which comes first, the chicken or the egg, but somehow this happens when you hit puberty. Now, when I say puberty, you got to realize that that puberty has been a moving target. Over the last probably 40 years, puberty has moved from an average of about 15 down to about probably 10 now. And it's a very scary thing. But when puberty hits, then all of a sudden, that poor teen's world is completely turned upside down. They've got hormones flowing through their body, and their brain is suddenly becoming rewired. Now, here's what happens in those early teen years. Teens enter what's called no man's land. And they've got physical changes going on in their body, obvious physical changes, but they have mental and spiritual changes going on too. And it's a very difficult time for teenagers, much more difficult than we as adults remember. And I want to spend a little bit of time unpacking that and talking about what that looks like. Here is the basic principle of training children to manage their own mind. The goal of a parent is to start, I call it roots to grow. They start with total parental control when the child is first born, and their goal is to release that control and teach the child how to take control of his own life, right? And so from 0 to 9, you are the principal contributor to that. Because from 0 to 9, and usually through to puberty, a child's world is built around trust. And when you're 5 to 7 to 8, the greatest hero in your life is usually your parents, right? It's not Spider-Man. It's not, you know, it's your parents. And there's a reason why God did that. Because that is the time when you have to instill all of the character virtues and spiritual virtues that you want to put into the life. That's the window that you have. Now, when puberty hits, that pendulum, which is way over here on the side of trust, all of a sudden, that pendulum swings clear over to the other side. And for the next decade, that teenager is going to call into question every more, every standard, every value, even everything that you have done as a family. All of those things are going to be called into question because the brain is going to reevaluate. Everything that has gone into that child, remember we talked about the subconscious mind. Subconscious mind is the world's greatest computer, right? Everything that has ever happened to you in your life, every conversation, everything that you have read, everything is indelibly recorded in the subconscious mind and will be in there your whole life. Now, the paths to those things that are in there, they become kind of overgrown, just like the path through the woods. And they become overgrown, and your recall becomes more and more and more difficult. But you have the ability to recall. A person who is a great reader will constantly refer to something that they read. Here's what concerns me about the millennial generation. Do you know what they usually refer to? A movie. Something will happen and they'll say, oh, that reminds me of such and such in such and such a movie, right? Because it's all in there. It's all stored in there. And so the principal means of reference for them is what happened in some movie. Now, is that not scary? Right. Okay. So, In this slide, the point I'm trying to make is that parents are in the process constantly of trying to release control to the child and to teach the child how to take his control of his own life. Because when puberty hits, then there comes a major jump and the pendulum swings clear to the other side. Now, you and I know people that the pendulum has never come back to center, right? You and I know people who have gone through life and they call into question if somebody in authority says it, as far as they're concerned, it's a write-off. They go through life as a rebel. You also know people whose pendulum has never swung and they go through life and they will say, that person, don't want to question that person. That person's a pastor or that person is an authority figure. We don't want to question them. And so they naively accept and believe. And those people are the ones that are the most susceptible to any type of the winds of new doctrine or they'll weave and flow their way, because anybody that comes along that is able to influence their mind, they'll follow after. But what happens is, as the pendulum swings during the years of puberty for that next decade, then the pendulum slowly comes back to the center. And with that center mark, you develop maturity. And so we're talking about two swings here. One is a physical hormone swing, and the other is a mental pendulum swing of your neurons in your brain. There is an explosion of neurons in your brain during those puberty years that redefine who that person is. Why is that? That's what we're going to get to. Okay. This teen's explosion has a very specific purpose. Around each neuron is what's called a myelin sheath. The myelin sheath, it's actually white matter, and it covers the neurons and keeps them from shorting out. Have you ever seen somebody with Parkinson's? What's happening with Parkinson's, or there's a number of diseases that are related to this, but what's happening is the myelin sheath is beginning to shrink and shrink and shrink, and areas in their brain begin to short out, and so they have no control over their movements or that type of thing. So, I mean, I'm not a medical person, so, you know, you can take this for what it's worth. But this teenager becomes very right-brained. And you wonder why it is that teenagers, they seem capable of making good decisions, you would think. Right? But they make the dumbest decisions. And when you ask them why, they say, I don't know. And it's true, they don't. Because what happens is the right brain, you'll see here that the right brain is experience-based. And so they move into this area of wanting experience-based. They want to experience, try everything, taste everything, just experience everything. They're afraid they're going to miss out in life because they become very right-brained. The left brain is where you have rationality and objectivity and the ability to logically weigh things in the balance. Okay, subconscious mind, remember we said that it's a computer that's imprinted and stored from birth, and it's also the place of judgment and moral values, and these areas, both judgment, moral values, and conscience are mainly external in those young years. What does that mean? That means that the parents are the primary guide and primary director of their judgment, their moral values, and their conscience. So their personal worldview is largely unshaped. They go with their parents. That's why that area over there is called trust. I don't want to get into this so deep that I'm boring you, but I want you to understand that in this process of reevaluation, we said yesterday that the subconscious is reprogrammed by repetition, not by logic or analysis. So in this process of transition from being a child to a parent, from a child to an adult, to becoming their own persons, from the teens through the 20s, teenagers are very, very open to imprinting. That's why they have such an idealistic world view. They have nothing to connect it to reality. The reason an adult of maturity can connect it to reality because they have the background of experience that they can evaluate against whatever it is. Teens and people in their early 20s don't have that. And so they're disconnected from reality. And as a result of that, their conscious mind is very fluid and ever-changing. And that's why universities take advantage of this. The major shaping of a worldview at this point in time, because of their idealism and their lack of experience, then their whole philosophy can be reshaped. And that's what happens. And there's two ways that it's reshaped. One is by evolution. The other is by humanistic philosophy. Do you know what humanistic philosophy states? In a nutshell, humanistic philosophy states there is no God, there is only one God, and it's within, and it's me. Now, you look at the transition that's taken place in the last 30 years to the me generation. This is all about me, right? Everything is about your being self-actualized and all of these things. Most of what you listen to, these humanistic views place self at the center of a young person's world. I must be self-actualized. I must experience. I must be treated in such a way. You know, it's all about me. I'm the center of the world. In 1950, they did a Gallup poll, and here's the question they asked: do you consider yourself to be a very important person? In 1950, 12% of that block, late teens, early 20s, 12% said that they considered themselves to be a very important person. They retook it in 1980. What percentage do you think? 80%. Right. Now, why do I spend so much time on this? Because we're going to move into two things. One is self-image and the other is character formation. And both of these are pivotal to character formation. But first, I want to spend a little time on self-image. What's self-image? What is self-image? It's a mental picture that you have in your head of who you are, right? Is it accurate? It's accurate as far as you're concerned in your mind. Is it accurate compared to reality? No. It's just the picture you have of who you are. Now, one of the self-image is a blueprint that you have, and I believe that one of Satan's greatest mortgages on the soul is that he has managed to give everybody in this world a lousy self-image. And I want to show you what I mean. I'm going to pick Ryan, come up here for a minute. Now, Ryan is a newlywed as of 6 days. No.
10 days.
10 days. He was married a week ago Sunday. This is his lovely wife, Sydney. Now, using Ryan as a little example, Ryan, in my mind, is a pretty handsome guy. Right?
Yes.
Right. Now, the one thing that I've noticed about Ryan is that he's a good dresser. Normally, I mean, you know, today might be exception, but normally he's a very good dresser. Now, I even today, I mean, you look sharp, you look handsome, you know, the outfit you got, everything looks good about Ryan today, except for the flip-flops he's wearing. And those are about the ugliest flip-flops I think I've ever seen. Okay, thank you. You can go sit down. Now, what's Ryan going to remember? Yeah, he won't remember one word about anything else that I said about him being handsome or generally being a good dresser. The one thing that he's going to remember is he's going to wake up at 2 o'clock tomorrow morning and he's going to roll over and say to Sydney, "Are my flip-flops really that bad?" You know? You what? If you were around Red Deer, you'd probably see him sneaking into a shoe store. My point in all that is that part of Satan's mortgage on the soul is that everybody, it doesn't matter who it is, has a lousy self-image. When I left our RV today and I was walking out the door, my wife said, "You look just like Jed Clampett." Now, my poor, sensitive self-image was crushed. Right? It would negate every other compliment that she gave me because that's the only one that I'm going to remember. Every time I put on that hat from now on, I'm going to think of Jed Clampett, you know, going with the rifle over his shoulder. Now stop and think what happens to a person's self-image. If they are raised in a home where praise is never offered, and where they're put down, criticism takes place. Suppose that they're raised in that type of environment. And they come off to college as a young person. And at college, they're a new senior in academy, let's say. And the teacher begins to say to them, you know, you're a very smart person. What do you think will happen? Their subconscious mind will start click, 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 all up and down the computer banks, right? And it would read every single situation through their life that showed that that was not true. And the evaluation that would come to their mind is they would weigh that statement by the teacher by all of the information that has come to them in the past, and they would say, something's not clicking. Either the teacher's lying to me or all the experience of my past is wrong. This is what I call Satan's mortgage on the human soul. And the reason that this is paramount is when it comes to talking about character, your self-image shapes your character. Now, it's not pivotal to your character, but you got to realize how it shapes your character. Okay, we keep going here. How does your self-image shape your worldview? How would it shape your picture of God? If you were bullied as an elementary child, right? And as you come through, it doesn't matter what happens as you mature, the fact that you were bullied and put down as a child will remain paramount in your subconscious mind. And so the glasses that you look at the world through will be colored by the event that happened to you. Now, you think about the fact that 25% of the women are sexually abused when they're children, right? What that must do to their self-image as an adult. Someone here at the camp here yesterday, there's a young millennial here, and first time ever been at camp, and somebody of the older generation came up to her and said, you can't park there. And she said, well, I've got a registration thing. He said, well, you won't be there next year because that belongs to somebody else and they're going to be back. And she said, well, I probably won't be back next year. So what does that do to a person's worldview of the church, right? How does that shape the worldview? The subconscious mind begins very, very early to build an image in your mind, a picture of who you are. And that subconscious mind is not reprogrammed by logic or analysis. It's reprogrammed by repetition. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about character formation. First of all, let me ask, what's the difference between personality and character? Is there any difference? What's the difference? Absolutely true. Personality has an effect on your character, but is personality and character the same thing? What's the difference? Aha! Bingo! Character is what is formed. Personality is what you are. Everybody has a basic style or type of personality. That basic type or style of personality changes very little over your lifetime. Now, there are situations, Florence Littauer, I remember her, she talks about masking. If you are brought up in a situation that's diametrically opposed to your personality, if you are a happy, joyful, loud child, and your parents are continue telling you to shut up and be quiet and you're annoying and all that kind of stuff, then you can mask that personality and you can become a very quiet person, you know, because of what happened in the past. But generally, your personality never changes. You're pretty well the kind of person you are. Either you're a sanguine type of person, or you're phlegmatic, easygoing, peacemaker type of person, or you're a melancholy type person who's very artistic and enjoys beauty and that type of thing, or you're a choleric, which is a born leader type person that just has an innate ability within you to organize and to lead and administrate and all those things. And nobody is all of them. There's no such thing as somebody that has all four. You have a basic personality. That's not character. The reason I bring that up is because Webster's definition of personality is the sum of the traits, habits, and behaviors of an individual that differentiates that individual from all others. The type of person you are, basically formed from birth, traits of your uniqueness in your personality as a tiny baby. Personality is somewhat shaped and developed over a lifetime in a limited way, but the basic traits are in your genes, and that's who you are. And that's all there is to it, right? Now, character. What is character? Character is the moral the moral qualities that intrinsically grow in your life. Right? What do you take to heaven with you? Not personality? Right. The two things that you take to heaven, we always talk about the only thing you take to heaven is character, and that's absolutely true. But your basic personality, God created you the way you are, and he happens to like you that way. And so when you get to heaven, you are going to be who you are. But character. Character is the power that radiates from within, that expresses itself in spiritual, mental, and moral domains of man. It's an inner quality, an inner strength that's within. You know, you meet some people in life that just impress you. That there's a certain consistent, settled, rooted something about their life that you're drawn to. They're not necessarily blown off course by storms or any new wind of doctrine that comes along. And you know that they've been through adversity, but somehow they just rise above it. They just radiate some type of an inner moral strength in their lives. If you see and find those people, you turn them into a mentor for yourself. One of the greatest mentors in my life was Sorensen. Remember Dr. Sorensen? That was he was the president in British Columbia for a while, and he was the Walla Walla. He was president twice in Walla Walla. Cliff Sorensen, right? And I often wondered what it was about him that he had such tremendous inner strength of character. I never saw him ruffled. I never saw him criticize anybody. I never saw him gossip about anybody. I never saw him lose his temper or anything like that. There was just a certain steadfast about him, an inner steadfast that I admired. It was a character, his character. Now here's the thing. He told me his story one time, his life story, how he was abandoned at a very early age. He put himself through high school. He lived in a cardboard box that he had made, and he worked, made his way through high school, put his way through university himself, and he went through tremendous adversity, and that adversity is what shaped his character. And it was a powerful illustration to me. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time. I don't know whether you can read this or not. I tried to figure out how to make it bigger, but what I want to talk about here is that it seems like we have, in this society that we live in today, we've created our own worst nightmare. And here's why. What I'm giving you here is an example between the character traits of a eulogy and the character traits of a resume. Right? So if you were at somebody's funeral and you were talking about their character traits, probably what you'd talk about is the serene and inner strength and constancy. In a resume, you would talk about they're ambitious, they're a go-getter, they're a winner, they're aspiring, they're motivated, they're determined. In a eulogy, you'd talk about their personal integrity. In a resume, you'd talk about their team player. In a eulogy, you'd talk about their self-discipline. In a resume, you talk about them being smart and astute. A eulogy, the totality of their life was in giving to others. In a resume, you talk about them being productive. Now, you notice the difference here? These are both character traits. What's the difference between the two of them? One is designed with inner moral virtues in the life. The other is what I call the outer world virtues that you would look for in a successful person. Now, as a society today, we value, Adam 1, the inner strength of moral virtue. But what we teach and school and shape our children in is Adam 2. And we hope that somehow they might catch a little bit of Adam 1. Do you see the difference? Now here's the great concern that I have in our education system. In our education system, and not just the Seventh-day Adventist education system, but all of the public education system, we focus almost exclusively on Adam 2. So what we create in the next generation are a whole society of Adam 2s with a huge deficiency in Adam 1. You see, character is the fruit grown in the garden of mind, four testimonies. Character doesn't come from the total accumulation of the subconscious mind. That's self-image. Character is much deeper than that. Character is the combination and the interdependencies of the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. Listen to this statement, five testimonies. Some men have no firmness of character. They are like a ball of putty and can be pressed into any conceivable shape. They have no definite form or consistency and are of no practical use in the world. They can be the most successful people in the world, but they're of no practical use. This weakness, indecision, and inefficiencies must be overcome. There is an indomitableness about a true Christian character that cannot be molded or substituted by adverse circumstances. Men must have moral backbone and integrity which cannot be flattered, bribed, or terrified. Okay. Here's the fruit of character that takes place in Adam 1 and Adam 2. If you emphasize Adam 1, I don't know whether you can read this or not, I'll read some of it. If you emphasize Adam 1, then the fruits of character that you would be looking at is humbleness, acute self-awareness, other-centered, soothing, gracious, thankful, and grateful, understanding that they are spiritually endowed but deeply flawed. They would be wise, acutely aware of their own weakness, gracious about others' weakness and hard on their own, aware of a greater world and a greater need than themselves, love for a truth that is on a higher plane than a love for popularity, understands the fine art of self-examination, ever open to constructive criticism, and gentle, considerate spirit. Now here's Adam 2. Egotistical, self-image concerned, competitive and self-promoting, jarring, Distinction, they look for distinction and praise hungry. Amazing ability to be blind to their own ignorance. Think they are knowledgeable. Complete unawareness of their own weakness. Judgmental and condemning of others who view light differently and who disagree with their views. Their world is the center of the universe. Have an insatiable love for popularity. Feed on flattery and praise. An inner desire to see themselves as superior to others. Defensive against any form of constructive criticism. Will lash out and retaliate. Selfish. Readily use others for their own advancement. Now, I went through that list, and immediately one person came to mind. I'm not necessarily a political person, but I gotta throw this in. Does somebody come to mind? There's a certain person down in the United States that fits every one of those criteria on the right. Perfectly. Now, here's the point in this, in terms of character formation. Children don't grow up to be what you want them to be. They grow up to be what you are. Remember, I said this yesterday. My grandmother used to say this. Children don't grow up to be what you want them to be. They grow up to be what you are. Character is shaped by the core values instilled in them. And how are they instilled? It's not what you read to them every night. It's not the prayers that you have with them. It's not what happens in school. It's not how you teach them to pray. It's how you do life. It's how you do life. I wish I could do it over again. I would like to have another shot at trying to exemplify these types of character of Adam 1 so that my children and their children could understand better. But we're human. Character isn't shaped by sermons in church. It's shaped by the crisis in your life and how you deal with it. Adam 2 achieves success by their victory over others. In this competitive world, you achieve success by winning victories over others. Adam 1 achieved success by winning victories over himself or herself. That's the difference. Character is a moral force radiating from within. It's the fruit of the quality of the soul. Listen to this. This is a very famous statement. The greatest want of the world is the want of men and women. Men who will not be bought or sold. Men who in their innermost souls are true and honest. Men who do not fear or call sin by its right name. Men whose conscience is as true to the duty as the needle to the pole. Men who will stand for the right though the heavens fall. And folks, that's what needs to be transmitted to the next generation. When my son was about 10 years old, we were driving. We had our tent trailer and we were driving to the coast to go. We were going to rent some four-wheelers. There's sand dunes down on the coast of Oregon. And we were going to rent some four-wheelers and go sand duning. And we stopped at a rest stop and it was getting dark. And I got out and I had no lights on the tent trailer. And so it got dark, and I was boogieing and trying to get to the campground where we had a reservation. And, of course, behind me, right? So the police comes up, and I roll down the window, and he says, "Did you know you had no taillights?" Now, the first thing that came to my mind was, no, really? You mean my taillights are out? Wow, I wonder what happened. Right? And I don't know what took over, but somehow the little nudge of conscience came, and I said, yeah, I know. I said, I checked them just as it was getting dark, and they were out, and I'm trying to get to the campground. And the police said, no problem, let me follow you. So we went to the campground. And the next day, we got on the four-wheelers. And the guy said to us, now, if you flip the four-wheeler, it's a $250 fine. Just want you to know up front. So we were, you know, having a great time roaring around the sand dunes and having a good time. And about halfway through the day, my son flipped his four-wheeler. So we got it upright, and there was no damage to it or anything like that. And so we, the end of the day, we went back and to turn them in. And I never said anything. I wanted to see what if he would say anything. So I never said anything. And he went over to the guy, and he said, I flipped my four-wheeler. And the guy looked at him, 10-year-old guy, and he said, looks okay to me. And that was the end of it. So that night around the campfire, I said to David, I said, I want you to know how proud I am of what you did. I said, that took a lot of inner strength to do that. Why'd you do that? He said, well, he said, when the cop stopped you, you were honest with them. I figured I should be too. Let me tell you, that was a powerful lesson in terms of character development for me. I want to talk to you a little bit about, I'm going the wrong way here. I want to talk to you a little bit about a term called cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance means, cognitive is mind, dissonance is conflict. So it means conflict of the mind. A child who has been raised with inner values, inner moral worth, even though the pendulum swings all the way over to the right and they re-examine every single moral virtue that has been instilled in them, those virtues may not go away. Now, when they become an adult, here's what happens. Let's assume that a gal is in love and she ends up moving in with her boyfriend, right? Now she has a moral dilemma that's called cognitive dissonance, because her inner moral compass will say, this is not right. I'm not married, right? And yet she is in a situation that is diametrically opposed to what her inner character values say. So she has to do one of two things. Either she has to get out of that situation, or she has to reprogram her mind and convince her mind that that is not a moral issue. And so she can readily do that. It's not very hard. Remember, by repetition, it's not necessarily logic that causes you to reprogram your mind. It's repetition. So if you say to yourself, well, I mean, we can't afford not to, or, you know, whatever reason that you make up in that situation, then you can completely reprogram your mind and do away with cognitive dissonance. In doing away with cognitive dissonance, you also do away with that little voice of conscience that speaks to your heart. Right? Now, this is exactly what happened. If you look down through the ages, this is exactly what happened. This is what happened in the concentration camps in Germany. There's a oh my. There's a picture in Dachau at the end of just as you leave Dachau. And there's a picture on the wall that was riveting to me, because it was a picture of a great huge ditch cut, and there were all these bodies laying in the ditch. And on one side of the ditch there was these these men standing there with rifles. And on the other side was lined up all these Jews. And the picture is of a mother and a father and a little boy, probably about 6, and a girl about 8, who are standing on the other side of the chasm. And they're standing there with their backs to the person on the other side with the rifle. And you can see a little smoke coming out of his rifle. And he's sitting having a smoke break. And he's got his lunch pail beside him. And he's having his smoke break. And the little boy and the little girl are looking over their shoulders like that. And they're watching him have a smoke break. That picture has haunted me for years. Now, how can a man have conscience that's so seared that he would sit there and have a smoke break, eat his lunch, pick up his lunch, go home to his family, come back the next morning to the same job? What happens to the human mind that allows that type of thing to go on? This whole area. Now we said, I'm just going to spend 2 minutes here on the conscious mind. The conscious mind, we said, is the citadel of the heart. It's the seat of decision making, the avenue to the soul, and it's also the seat of character. And your conscious mind is shaped and reshaped through your whole life, even though it's the decision maker. The conscious mind is unique to mankind. The conscious mind is the captain of the ship. And it is the filter for the subconscious mind. Remember, we said that the subconscious mind accepts everything at face value and will respond with the appropriate emotions or whatever according to what it's fed, and it regurgitates to the conscious mind. It stores it, analyzes it, and then gives feedback to the conscious mind. Your mind is your great friend if you control it. Your mind is your greatest enemy if it controls you. Satan exercises his power. Now, we're going to spend some time tomorrow talking about, we're going to talk about virtual reality, hypnotism, and how Satan gets direct access to the human mind and bypasses the conscious mind. So we're going to spend a little bit of time looking at that, because it's pivotal in terms of understanding where moral virtues come from. Okay. Satan exercised his power of hypnotism over an Adam and Eve, and this power he strove to exercise over Christ. But after the word of Scripture was quoted, Satan knew he had no chance of triumphing. The tempted one needs to understand the true force of the will. This is the governing power in the nature of man. The governing power is not our conscious mind. It's not where we make decisions. The governing power in the mind, in the human mind, is the will. So we're going to spend a little bit of time on that and talk a little bit about that tomorrow. I don't want to go over or use up somebody else's time, but what's that? If you want some profound reading, there's 3 little books called Character. That's by Ellen White. Mind, Character, and Personality. That's it. Yeah. Yeah, powerful, powerful reading. I've got one more book I want to share with you. This book is not a Christian book. It's written by a man by the name of David Brooks, and this is a New York Times bestseller right now. And it's called The Road to Character. This is a powerful book, because he starts off talking about the virtues of character, and as he goes through, he begins giving biographies of different people's lives who had great character traits in their lives. And then he ends up with Augustine, of all people. And from Augustine, he goes into the process of conversion. And he bases it on what Augustine wrote, but he's really talking. It's a powerful, powerful read in terms of the process that goes on in terms of giving up one's own self and surrendering it to Jesus Christ. Now, how in the world that became a New York bestseller, but it is a profound read. My son gave this to me, and I really enjoyed this book, and this is where I got that material on Adam 1 and Adam 2, because he talks about that in this book. So I would suggest this book and the three volumes on Mind, Character, and Personality by Ellen White. Okay, let's pray.